No, I got fine. It'll be to your subscourses next.
Yeah. Oh yes. Are we ready to go?
No, just give it another couple of turns.
So you've left Hotspur, you're in hostile, your captain is Richmond.
Maxwell Richmond, yes.
And you're in Salima Creek.
Yeah. So that was a ship handling exercise that was good to see. And, the stories were not ever allowed in the Grand Harbor, which is full of battleships, cruisers, battlecruisers, northern aircraft carriers.
What's the biggest fleet you went to sea with in the Mediterranean?
I guess the combined fleet exercises in the spring, where the Mediterranean fleet and the home fleet met for exercises. And then afterwards, of course...
Tell me how many ships you saw. Like, so many battleships, so many...
I never really counted them up, but it was, for me, or for us at that time, it was an awesome sight. There would be two or three aircraft carriers. There would be two battle cruisers. I should think four or five battleships, Nelson, Broughton, Warspite, Huey, Malaya, Ross, the Arcas in the home fleet. And then all these destroyers up in the pens near the coal yards at the north end of Gibraltar. Cruisers, of course. Some ships would have to anchor outside in the bay. The destroyers coming into the pens at the north end. I'd just like to describe one. The captain of Havoc was a man called Sweaty Courage. passed over to a commander who'd forgotten more about the stars than a lot of people ever knew. And he would bring his ship into the pens. His stem would go past the end of the pen at 12 knots, and he would berth her. He would go full astern, of course, and end up just beautifully alongside with the stem just a few feet from the concrete head of the thing. It's a performance that I viewed with wonder.
I think Sweaty applied more to the onlookers than to him.
Goodness me, yes. Yeah, it was really a tour de force.
Yes.
But I'm not quite sure why his career didn't prosper. But certainly he demonstrated how the story should be handled. I suspect possibly excessively so.
Yeah.
So that would, I hope that answers that question.
Well, your seamanship examinations are coming up for sub-lieutenant. Yes. You've done your cruiser time and your destroyer time.
And I'd just like to throw in
that aircraft carrier.
We also went to sea in the Courageous.
Yes, tell us about Courageous then.
did you go to sea in Courageous? No, we didn't. She was alongside for refit, so our air time was a bit of a frost, but we were sent out to Halfar Airport and given ground instruction and then flew from Halfar in Swordfish. That was my first flight in the back seat of a Swordfish in this huge cockpit with a sort of piano wire umbilical cord securing me to this thick structure so that if we turned it upside down, I wouldn't fall out. That was where the observer normally sat, and we were open to the breezes. But it was a marvelous experience to fly over Grand Harbor and be able to look down on the fleet and look down on Malta generally.
Did you pass messages to the pilot by hand?
Prodding in the back with a forefinger. Yeah. Yes, there were some new electronic marvels in those days. Mm. And Bob Murdoch did his airtime. It was all almost a little bit hairy, I think.
Mm. Well, she was a sedato lady, the Swordfish.
Yes, 95 knots flat out
and
still air. Mm-hmm. And the other thing was, so when we finally left the Mediterranean, we took passage in HMS Royal Sovereign to England. And that was my only time in a battleship. Harry Winnett was a senior engineer in Royal Sovereign. And so I always seemed to be fortunate to find a Canadian somewhere.
Yes.
And one was most desired. And we did our engineering time in the Royal Sovereign. And we had to do a minimum number of hours or days.
You kept engine room watches.
That's right. And I was so glad that I could become an engineer. The noise and heat and steam and confusion.
Well, they're a strange lot. They are glad they weren't executive officers. So.
So that finished our time in the Mediterranean. We worked very hard for our seamanship exam, and that was one of the big hurdles, as you know, to do well in seamanship before the board. Fortunately for us, I'm talking about Murdoch and I suppose the rest of it, particularly myself, one of the members was one of the destroyer captains, Chapman, who said nice things about destroyers. Obviously, your prospects improve. And both Murdoch and I came out of there with the first.
Good.
First.
Yeah. Good.
And the first in seamanship was quite an achievement, I think.
Yeah.
Well, later in my other courses with enforcement. So we went back to England and some leave, and then to join the schools and enforcement for sub defense courses.
You took your leave in England?
Yes.
You probably had relatives there?
Friends, yes, distant relatives, yeah. In Plymouth and so forth. I should say that we had been away 2 years. By the time we were halfway through our mids time, and so we were allowed foreign service leave, and so Murdoch and Pullen took off from Malta, and the night of Malta, the little ferry that ran across to Sicily, and catch a train, and we traveled by train from Sicily right across Europe to catch a ferry across to England and into London, and then to catch a ship to Canada, and a train at Montreal to go to Wokeville. It's really quite an undertaking.
Isn't it? By train from the Middle East to Oakville.
Yes. And the trains were out, the sign on the train said, E. Pericoloso, Spo Jersey. It is dangerous to stick your head out of the window.
Oh.
But it was good fun. And it was a time when Mussolini's chaps were jumping up and down. There were a lot of fancy uniforms and arrogant-looking Italians speaking about.
Yeah.
And, the
well, the Abyssinian War is about to...
Yes. Yes.
Starter, it was on.
Yeah. Yes, 36, 37.
We're getting up to 38 now.
Yeah, that's right, yes. So Munich has passed.
Oh, Munich has passed. Yeah, I guess it is.
So we were going on to the big event, I think.
Tell me about your leave in Oakville. How long did you get there?
We were... 60 days. 30 days a year, foreign service leave. That's right. It was 2 months.
Yeah.
And it was in the summer, and it was great fun.
Yeah.
And it was difficult because it was long enough for one to fall back into the pattern that was so familiar before I joined the Navy. The wrench to break yourself loose again and go back into this new world.
Yeah. Yeah.
What I did. I remember I slammed the car door and caught the end of my finger in it, and it was a rather nasty injury, and so I got an extension for about 10 days, I think. So Murdoch went back ahead of me.
I knew Oakville in the 30s. I was from Toronto in those years. It was a pleasant little town, wasn't it? It's a bit bigger now. It's still pleasant.
The old Oakville, the core is
yeah,
now.
Well, the downtown bit, that row of houses where all the artisans lived, the shipwrights. And,
yes, with the plaques on
them. The plaques on them, yeah.
Yes.
I play tennis there when I'm there. I have friends there. Yeah.
Oh, yes. Well.
So you're back in UK for subs courses, and you went to...
We went to Vernon first, the torpedo school, and then to Whelan, HMS Excellent, HMS Drive, the barracks.
What did you do in the barracks?
We were there for the signal school part of our course, and then Dryad at the end, and it was navigation school, and did the exams, and passed all, some better than others. I got a first real island, which was I didn't do very well in Dryad. I hoped I would have done better in Vernon and Torpedo. In the signal school, I didn't. It was a wretched 2.5 who I could establish no rapport with. I don't think a lot of others would agree. He was a very poor instructor, in my view. Didn't do as well as I should have or could have. Look at that.
I've been collecting stories about sub-lieutenants passing out from Whale Island. Peter Chance was actually in the class that planted the tree in Whale Island, when they were told to remove the tree, they blew it up.
I've heard the story all my life, and Peter Chan said that was my class.
It was, I can't tell any funny stories about Whale Island. I think because the course was so short.
Yeah.
All the courses were short. Everything was rushing towards the precipice, and never was really no time for hijinks.
No.
But the Peter must have been under the same auspices there. I don't know. But some courses, I have no particular memory of Whale Island as a sub-lieutenant.
Wasn't then that you wanted to become a gunnery officer, or was it before that, or during that, or after that?
Well, I guess the idea was dormant in my mind, because my brother was a gunnery officer, and I'll come to that if I have an opportunity later.
Yeah.
But specialization was the last thing in my mind at the time. But we were doing subs courses at Whale Island when the war broke out.
Because John Charles and Bob Timbrell were there at the time of Dunkirk.
Yes, yeah.
John Charles went around the coast mounting 6-inch guns.
Did he?
He mounted about 18 of them.
Did he?
To Operation Sea Lion. Their Sea Lion was bruited. Troops were arriving back from Normandy, and he was mounting 6-inch guns with a lieutenant. He was a sub, a lieutenant from Whaley, and a bunch of hands. And Bob Timbrell got a yacht and sailed off to Dunkirk and took back a bunch of soldiers.
Yeah. The 3rd of September 1939, 11 o'clock on a Sunday morning, the balloons went up, the silver balloons. Neville Chamberlain said this thing over my radio in the little cabin in the huts at the back.
Yes.
And so we finished off quite quickly, and Assiniboine was commissioning in Devonport.
Of course, yes.
And I was appointed to Assiniboine as West Commissioner.
Yeah. So there you are in your first Canadian ship.
Yes.
Assiniboine in Devonport in 1939.
Yes. Joined on the 23rd of October.
Yeah. Just after war. Who else was in the Assiniboine with you?
Well, the Mingy was the captain,
a
man I admired very much.
Who you what?
Admired very much. J.C. Hibbard was the first lieutenant.
Mm-hmm.
Willie Porteous was the engineer officer.
Here you
chief.
Go.
Chief.
And Hennessy.
Hennessy and Pullen were the sub-lieutenants.
The gunner.
Bud was the gunner chief.
That's about it, you know.
Ernie Jones was there. Hannah Brock was there.
These are the RCNVRs.
Yes, I think they joined a little later.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Miss Medlin?
I think I've got to look at the
wardrobe
in 39.
That's enough. We've got the Navy list, but this gives me enough to talk about. Would you know about Mingy as captain of the Assiniboine? Will you talk about him as captain of the Assiniboine?
Yeah, I'd never met him before, but before we actually commissioned him, he took us out and dined us and took us on drives around the countryside, he was my first Canadian captain, really.
Yes.
And I was I've always admired Rollin Mingy. During my career, I kept meeting him, of course.
It's in his young years that I'd like to get memories, because as a petty officer, told me he had to do some navigation examinations. Why he had to do them, I don't know. But anyway, Lieutenant Mingy spent a lot of time with me, he said, and helped me pilot the exam, I guess.
Yeah.
This is Lieutenant Mingy spending his own time
to
help this petty officer pass his pilotage examination.
Well, I would say that's consistent with what he did throughout his time. And certainly as the commander of Assiniboine, He helped us.
Another officer said to me, he was always saying to me, suppose this happened, what would you do? Suppose this happened, what would you do?
Who's Ingy saying this? Yes, he did.
And he said, this was infuriating to me. He said it wasn't going to happen, but then I realized 6 months later that there was nothing that could happen that I wouldn't have gone over in my own mind what I would do. And he said he was very good at training. He was a sub, whoever this was.
I can remember Mingy, this was later when we were down in the Caribbean and we were making a landfall off Aruba in the Dutch West Indies. And we were all on the bridge looking for the first sight of land. This was before the days of Exotica like radar. Whereas Robbie says the Mark I eyeball with our binoculars. No wonder we all wear glasses now. And Mingy, the captain, appeared on the bridge and said, well, a fine lot you are, here. As he said, now look over there. And abaft the beam on the port side was the land that we were looking for, which we expected to see ahead. Because we expected to see it ahead, that's where we kept on looking. And so this was a little lesson to a lot of people on the bridge.
That's typical of what I've heard before.
Such things. So he wasn't, he did these things quietly, but with a great effect. There were no histrionics.
No.
I don't think I ever saw him jumping up and down, throwing his cap in the air, or whatever.
Yeah.
So he was a good counterpoint for...
Jimmy Hibbert.
For the first lieutenant who...
Who was very excitable.
Yes, he was quite excitable. I can remember Harry Freeland, who was an RCNR lieutenant. He came to us from the CN Steamships, Lady Nelson, Lady Rodney. He was the navigator and a good one, good quite a character. And I was the forecastle officer. Everybody in the wardroom ran a sort of joking around a sweepstake as to when Jimmy Hibbert would get so excited during some evolution that he would, when jumping up and down, jump right out of the bridge and land on B-M deck. But the advice one got through a megaphone from the bridge of Assiniboine when trying to secure to a buoy or weighing or dropping an anchor certainly was exciting.
Yes.
And when you're the sub-lieutenant on the forecastle or handling cables and anchors, you're very exposed to obstruction from the bridge.
Yeah, quarter deck is better.
I'd much rather be under the Y-gun shield.
I used to play squash with Porteous. He was a jovial fellow.
I did too. Yes, I liked Willie Porteous. He was a good egg. He worked hard to... I think he certainly played hard.
Yeah.
He was a good chief. Nothing ever went wrong with his department. And it's odd to have a Commander E as a chief of the destroyer. The latter days of
the
destroyer.
We only had six destroyers, didn't we? Yeah.
Yes.
He needed the sea time. As an engineer, nobody could ever criticize Porteous's engineer. The Gunner T must have been a shaping influence in you and Hennessy?
Yes, it was probably good for Hennessy and Bullen to have Pat Bouches the guy. He certainly kept us on our toes. And he also had a great deal of experience and knowledge to impart. And I thank him for what he did to improve my knowledge with the Navy in many ways.
Well, I'll tell him when I get back to Victoria. Yeah.
Well, he was good.
Yeah.
I was the so-called gunnery officer of the ship, which is not much of a grand title for a not terribly important job, I suppose, but I was the PCO, gunnery control officer, and doing my best to organize the department. But old P.D. Budge didn't allow us how I was really much of a gunnery officer, and he wouldn't think so unless I got my big G, which I eventually did. He was good. It was a very happy wardroom.
Of course, he was a very happy man, Pat Budge. He always had... He did a lot of work and he had fun doing it.
He had a lot of fun doing it. He was full of fun. but there was always a message there. I mean, it was still a learning process. And, I think we were, Ralph and I were fortunate to have served with him in that ship. We spent some time in the West Indies. After we got back to Canada from Devonport, we were sent south to help round up what was left of the German merchant ships caught out there when war broke out.
Yeah, you caught one, didn't you?
We were involved in the capture of one, the Hanover. On our maiden voyage.
Can you tell me a bit about that? Jimmy Hibbert doesn't really remember that much.
Well,
and you might won't remember that much, but you remember some more. Was there anything of any drama occur?
Well, we were working with an RN cruiser.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I've got her name.
Dunedin?
Yes, Dunedin.
Dunedin, and we were patrolling the escape routes. I think we were in the Mona Passage.
You were.
And she was somewhere in another one. Yeah. And we were expecting these ships to be heading back for Germany, understandably so. And one of them was the big liner, the big, was it the Columbus? German liner that was out there. And it was a bit nerve-wracking to be patrolling a narrow waterway like that at night, with no radar, with binoculars, in certain knowledge that ships would be coming through dark and at high speed. It became terribly important not to let your attention wander, keep your eyes glued to the surrounding horizon. But it was Dunedin that started the thing. She intercepted the Hanover, and we went with her assistance. And we endeavored, when we arrived, I think they made an abortive attempt to scuttle the ship. I think there was a fire on board.
They set fire to her,
and we tried to go alongside to put the fire out, get pumps on board. We made an attempt to tow her, take her under tow. I don't know if I say we're engaged on the forecastle of the Assiniboine to get a wire out to the bow of the Hanover, and just to get a wire onto her, even if we towed her in a not generally accepted fashion.
Yes.
And whether we were towing her clear of the lee shore, or what, I'm not quite sure.
You were just inside territorial water, I know.
Yeah, that's the, yes,
you wanted to get her out.
Get her out, yes. So the operation was successful, but I'm probably turning over hard pressed to come up with details.
Well, there's a lot that's written, but
I can remember though this was a case where much shouted advice came from the front of the bridge to the to that wretched subattendant on the forecastle.
Yeah.
But if I remember, I think Budgie came up to lend me a hand.
I'm sure he did.
And sort of to help the sub out.
Yeah.
Which is a typical budget.
Yeah. Well, it's the same sort of thing as you were talking about, the rapport between the your boat's crew and the midshipman. Yeah. But she was always help you out if you were in an embarrassing position. What did happen to her?
She was eventually rescued and appropriated.
And
it was renamed Audacity, if I remember correctly, and Carrot was one of these Mack ships.
Yeah.
And I think it's eventually lost.
She was, but we did use her.
Yeah.
Like the submarine Graf.
Yeah. So it was a good show. It was all a bit exciting because the war just started. And here
I think she was the only one you intercepted, wasn't she?
Yeah.
Yeah. And after Dunedin, then you went to... You didn't move, but what happened to Assiniboine?
Yeah, we went back to north to Halifax and became engaged in... the convoys that sailed for
3 days out and back again.
Some of the troop convoys we were involved in too.
Troop convoy one left about December.
Yes.
Did you take her out?
I believe so.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Is Rollo Mingy still there?
No. Now there were a bunch of changes here. We had G.C. Jones was captain for a while. Johnny Stubbs was sort of. We had Ricky Sterling as a first attempt for a while. We took quite a few convoys, but at that time they weren't right across.
No.
They were, there was one to Iceland, of course. Two convoys from the National Halifax to Iceland.
But you couldn't take them all the way.
No, we were at a fuel restriction.
Talk about G.C. Jones as captain. He didn't have that much time in command.
No, I liked G.C. Jones. Mm-hmm. I thought he was not fun, but a bit of a character. He was shooting his cuffs, and he was going to go in rapid promotion at this time, and finding it difficult to get sufficient to get the right go break.
Yeah.
I think he was a fine sight as an admiral.
Yeah.
But he was, Johnny Stubbs was his sort of right-hand man, I think. I wasn't on the bridge, but I suspect Johnny Stubbs was very much of a ship handler.
Yeah.
It was that time that I had a great deal of, I admire Johnny Stubbs. He's an able fellow. Mm-hmm. Best one. Okay. I had his sword.
Talk about Johnny Stubbs for a while then. You have his sword. How did you get that?
Ruth. Ruth gave it to Jock McGillivray.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, he didn't have it with him. And Jock McGillivray offered it to me.
Nice. I met Jock at the Union Club a few years ago. Is he still
Jock?
At the Rideau Club a few years ago? Is he still alive?
He's still. Jock McGillivray?
Yeah.
Oh, yes, I play golf with him every Thursday. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because I know he plays with Harry the Wolf and occasionally with Royal Hennessy. This is the one over in Hull, the Royal Ottawa.
Yeah. Jock's a member of Highlands, where I play. Yes, he's fine. So I have John Stubbs' sword with his name on it, which I treasure it because we were shipmates.
Mm. Where's that going?
Well, that should go to some appropriate place.
Maybe his school? I don't know. There's a John Stubbs High School out west.
Is there?
Mm-hmm. I mean, you can think about this, but I feel...
Well, I've got a few things that I want to make
I feel rather forward. Like that... Those old shrews in Scrooge's Christmas that are in sorting over his clothing now that he's died. You remember that bit of A Christmas Carol? But it's important to Alec Douglas to know where things are.
Yeah.
That's of national significance because Stubbs, he hasn't had that much publicity. It's not the Canadian way, but he is a Canadian hero. And as you say, it should go to some appropriate place.
Well, I would wish it to.
Of course you would.
I don't know.
Well, just keep
as long as Alec Douglas knows I've got it.
Yeah.
That's the main thing.
Yeah.
And that is my wish, in case I should be run over by an elephant before I get home to my pen and paper.
Well, what is there to say about Stubbs, except he was a fine officer?
Yes, he was. He demonstrated that early on, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, show me how.
Well, by his... There was the quiet competence with which the whole staff operation was planned. G.C. Jones was the senior officer, Captain D at that time.
Yeah.
He was still afloat. This is before they decided the best place was ashore. And so a great deal of responsibility fell on John Stubbs to see that all the operational orders were, and maybe the operation itself was carried out in the proper fashion. In an organization that really was trying to find its feet, I think, in the early days of the war.
What was he like socially in the wardroom?
Delightful.
Yeah.
Delightful.
Lots of fun.
Quiet. Yeah. And a delightful sense of humor. Sardonic, I guess. Thought he was a first-class fellow.
Now, you must be noticing a difference. You've served under some RN destroyer captains, and now you've served under two Canadian destroyer captains. What's the difference in their approach?
Well, I didn't really notice all that much difference, really, because they had been trained in the RN. I had been trained in the RN, and we brought RN habits and ideas and customs, I suppose, with us. And some people think that may not have been good. I was aware early on in my... career in Canada, that you were dealing with different people. So the ship's companies and the RN and ship's company and the paying ships, there was a difference.
Now this is important.
That was apparent to me as a young officer at the outset, and I tried to adapt myself to the fact that I was not dealing with the ship's company and the ship like the Shropshire or the Sussex, but to Canadians. I was a Canadian myself, and it was a bit hard on us being trained in the RN and being immersed in that sort of an atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
But we were still Canadians. And a period of readjustment, I think, was necessary on the part of all Canadians who came back from the Royal Navy. so that they could fit into the Canadian ships without getting the ship's companies in the state of bloody mindedness.
Well, this is not to denigrate anybody, but it must be said because it seems to be so. I've interviewed petty officers that were in a cruiser when Brock was the commander and when he had that trouble. And he didn't adapt to, as far as I can make out from what other people have told me, to the Canadian sailor as opposed to the Royal Naval sailor, who's quite different. And that is one of the dangers of spending too long in the RN. Now, they gave lovely professional training, but many people say, of course, Dickie Lear goes to the extreme and says we shouldn't have had anything to do with the RN at all, but Dickie Lear goes to the extreme and everything. But it was one of the weaknesses of our early training. The professional training was good, yes, but if you didn't adapt to the Canadian way of doing things when you got back, you were in trouble. And you saw that.
I agree. Yeah. I never had any, I don't think I ever had any.
Because you were away 4 years nearly.
Yeah, I know.
Had a very formative embryonic period.
That's right. And I had never come into contact with the Canadian sailor before that. Mm-hmm. In retrospect, maybe it would have been a good idea for cadets to have spent some time with the fleet before they were sent off to the RN, just so that they might see for themselves at that formative stage what they would be coming back to.
In retrospect, that's true. Yeah. Nobody saw it that way at the time. You just went off as an automatic thing. Well, that's fine. But now there's another thing I wanted to ask you. You had Ernie Jones and Panner Brock, and they were peacetime RCNVRs.
Yeah.
But there was a certain antipathy between the RCNVRs and the RCN and the RCNR in the early stages of the war.
Not in Russia.
Good.
I thought that Panner Brock and Ernie Jones were they were tremendous.
They were both RMC boys, of course, weren't they?
I suppose they were, yes. Bob Pendy was also in the same way.
Well, Bob Pendy is truly an extraordinary RCNVR.
Well, maybe we were extremely fortunate in the Cinnabon, but I've heard all this rubbish about the RCN and the RCNVR. I think it's the book by Lamb that bothers me very much. I really think it's a load of old rubbish.
I spoke to Jimmy Lamb about that, and he admits that it's a flaw.
But it bothered me very much because I spent my whole life in this business, and I don't. I think these are dangerous generalizations. And I can't think of one RCN officer who wouldn't have given anything to have got the hell off to sea during the war, and they weren't allowed to. They had to use their experience to train. To suggest otherwise is an affront, I think, and
well, for your satisfaction, I took that point up with Jimmy Lamb, mm-hmm. and he admits it was a flaw.
Right.
I said, where else would they be? We didn't know anything about running a navy. We didn't know anything about running a corvette, for God's sake, let alone a navy.
Yeah.
And he had thought of it before. He said, yes, it was a flaw.
I'm glad you, but the trouble is that book's in print and will remain in print, I guess. But my experience was that we could have done anything without the Panner Brocks and Bob Hendy's and Ernie Jones's of our time. And I think the training they got in the destroyers early on enabled them to go on to bigger, better things and permitted us to pump up this great balloon that we created.
Where did only Ernie Jones and Panner Brock go? I knew them both, and I don't know where they went. Did they get command?
I don't know.
I think Panner Brock got a corvette or a frigate.
Yes, I think they all did well. And Tony Coghlan was another one.
And Tony Coghlan was Jimmy Hibbert's number one in Iroquois.
That's right.
Also a big G.
Yeah. So,
Yeah, well, you've mentioned four fine fellows.
Yeah.
I think what happened was that, if you were above 26, you became a lieutenant. I was in an armed merchant cruiser, and we were short of watchkeepers. And I remember the commander saying one day, good, we're getting a lieutenant. And a lieutenant RCNVR came on board, and he had been 3 weeks in the Navy, or four, or six, but he knew nothing. And they took a pretty dim view of this in this RNAMC, that there was a lieutenant that knew nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it might have been that, but I don't know what Paragraph was thinking about. Or what Jimmy Lamb was thinking about. Let's leave it to the state school. All right.
The other point I want to make is that there's also a suggestion that between the destroyers and the corvettes, there was a sense that the corvettes were all VR and the destroyers were all RCN. And the point I'm trying to make also is that this is not so, that half the officers in the destroyers were VRs.
Yeah.
And there were, as you know, of course, that in the corvettes there were also RCN officers.
Yeah.
And so again, it's not as simple as it
is. Well, Freddie Grubb had command of a corvette, I know, and Gus Bolton got command of a destroyer.
Yeah, yeah. So, anyway.
We've set that ghost. We've laid that ghost. Talk about Mickey Sterling as a shipmate in those days.
Oh, he was good. He was fine. Elegant Mickey, and with his silk handkerchief flowing out of his sleeve and his monocle.
And a cane.
And a cane, yes.
And a monocle, yes. I remember the monocle.
I have a picture of him in the wardrobe. See, PM Magazine. Remember the New York publication? It's rather like USA Today.
I remember that.
I have a picture that was taken, and they did an article on the Assiniboine of Mickey sitting in a chair with his feet resting on the rum tub with the king, God bless him, with his monocle and the full, and a glass of sherry.
Oh, yes, always sherry.
So,
gin's rather vulgar.
But I think that was a deceptive image that he was projecting, and he was a very efficient fellow.
Oh,
but he was signal school, and this was signal
the
school.
Handkerchief, the drooping handkerchief out of the left-hand sleeve is mandatory.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So...
I passed him in Oak Bay the other day, and I had dropped into a tea shop called The Blethering Place, and I had on a pair of khaki shorts, shorts, it was a month or so ago, gym shoes, and a sweatshirt, and the dog. I'd been walking the dog on the beach, and as I came out, I picked up my dog, and... Really, I passed Mickey Sterling. I felt quite ashamed of myself. He looked so beautiful.
Still, well,
and he doesn't weigh an ounce more than he did then.
No.
I felt terribly scruffy.
Yeah, he was a good first account, and again, it was a very happy team, very group. I think that we were meant to be pros, and I think we comported ourselves as
well. From what you've just described. Mickey Sterling said this, I quote him. He said, I've asked him the same question about the RCM and the RCMVRs. He said, well, after all, he said, I just described what I did as a cadet, as a midshipman, and as a sub. I reckoned I was a pro.
Mm-hmm.
And when I came back and met some of the RCMVRs, yes, I suppose I did feel a bit that way about the amateurs. He said, I suppose I did.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a natural enough thing, but I'm glad that you commented the way you did. It isn't really for you or me, Tommy, to moralize about it. We just want to put on record what happened, how people felt for Dr. Douglas and his fellow historians, you see. And this is the way we felt, and this is good for them to know, but it sure as heck isn't written anywhere. Except Jimmy Lamb's, and I'm rebutting that in a book I'm writing now anyway, so the rebuttals are not as good as the first thing, but it's going to, a protest is going to be registered by me, and I told Jimmy Lamb that. Now, you've got a new captain after G.C. Jones. Who was that?
We had a succession call. It seems we had Billy Cuff Taylor for a while.
Yeah, you do. Somebody told me he often had a different captain...
Yeah.
On successive trips.
I think we even had Rastus Reed, didn't we, for a short time?
I think you did. So...
It's a sort of chaotic...
Who was it that Cuff Taylor disliked and liked, and he was equally disliked by him? Was that... There was a great antipathy between two of them. Was it Jones and Taylor? Murray and...
I don't know. I can't... I wouldn't address that. I don't know.
Did Murray ever go out with you?
Murray, yes. He did. The whole thing is a cataract of memories now, and kaleidoscopic, I suppose you could describe the command of the Assiniboine at one stage.
Yeah.
And we just got on with it.
But well, we're still in 1939, and the war is pretty confusing to us right now. The troops are flooding in from all across Canada.
Yeah, yes. we had a refusal to fall in situation in the cinema. Did you know about that?
G.C. Jones handled it.
Yes, yes. And I can remember...
Tell us what you remember, yeah.
Well, I can remember it was Hans Holland 115, and they didn't fall in. And Mickey was the first to tell. Mm-hmm. G.C. Jones, the captain. Chief Petty Officer Hobday was the coxswain.
H-O-B-D-A-Y.
That's right.
I know him, yeah.
And... Well, the thing was quickly resolved, and we all went forward into the mess decks, Ralph and I, and Mickey, and I think G.C. Jones, if I remember correctly, stirred up the troops and told them not to be so silly, and
they didn't lock themselves in there.
Oh, no. But the fine hand of Chief Petty Officer Hobday, coxswain, link between the officers and the men, was responsible for this. He was running with the... hare and hunting with whatever it is.
Hunting with the hounds, yeah.
Yeah, and really betraying his trust, I think. And I never forgotten that man's name. And if I ever came across him while I was serving, I wouldn't have anything to do with him. I don't know what happened to him.
No.
But it was a flash in the pan, and it was sorted out.
Mm.
And I see nothing wrong. I see nothing wrong in that. Especially in the early days of the Canadian Navy's vast expansion, though it hadn't been diluted at that point.
I wonder what they were complaining about. Leave, I guess. You didn't get much time in, you know.
Yeah, could well be. I was never concerned about that. I thought we were required to do our stuff. Didn't matter about leave. We just got on with it. But provided leave was fair across the board. I mean, officers weren't getting leave, and men weren't.
That's the case of that.
But that I remember that in my time at Assiniboine. The other one was we were coming out of Halifax Harbor, and I was living in the after cabin flat, and I think we went full stern or something. And in the after cabin flat, that's a fairly interesting experience, and indicates that something of significance is about to happen. And I rushed up the ladder to the quarter deck, but the hatch was shut, and I concussed myself.
Did you?
And had to be wheeled off to the hospital. Shrieks of laughter in the wardroom, of course. The TC would try to go to the quarter deck while first opening the hatch. I think I got a few chiacings from GC himself.
Did you? Just a second. Well, who was your final captain, and when did you leave?
I left Assiniboine in 20th of January, 1941, to specialize in gunnery.
What happened between the time we've just talked about in January 1941, just
the standard sort of convoy operation.
3 days out and back in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I applied to do the long gunnery course because my brother was a gunnery officer. It seemed to be the thing to do. If ever I regret something in my naval career, it was applying them to do that long gunnery course, or even applying at all. And the people who guided our destinies in Ottawa, I'm talking about officers' appointments, really didn't know what they were about, because they accepted my request and put it through, and I was appointed to excellent for the January 1941 long course. When I joined HMS Excellent, I had 2 weeks in as lieutenant, I think. And I was joining a group like Michael Pollock and Carew Hunt, officers who had 3-4 years of service, had been had good war experience, even at that time. I was way out of my depth. And if I had just stayed a salt horse, like Ralph Hennessy sensibly did, I would have had command much sooner. I'd had a more interesting war. I might have made a better contribution, I don't know. But I joined Whale Island then, under those circumstances, and I was scrambling to keep up. And Madrick was the other fellow who were termates, as it were, for that 1941 long course, which lasted 6 months.
Yeah.
And, I mean, when it came to a lot of the sort of advanced gunnery stuff, it was really quite a struggle for me, calculus and a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in the middle of a blitz, so Portsmouth had been bombed to hell, and
we were in class all day and up all night, fire watching, manning the guns. And eventually it caught up with me. I think it was about two-thirds way through the course. I was studying CB 1925, the director handbook, which you may recall was about that thick with a blue cover.
Yeah.
I don't know how late at night in my room, and my nose started to bleed. And it bled for a week. I couldn't stop it. There was nobody in the building that you could get hold of. There was hall porter. There was no telephone. There was no medical aid. And my cabin by morning time was a sea of blood. The PMO came in and gave me a hell of a rocket for such a mess, quite ignoring the fact that I was sick. And they took me over to Hathor Hospital. I was there, I don't know how long. I was in a ward where when the siren sounded, they removed everybody and I was left alone because I was too weak to move. That's a pretty lonely place to be, and you can hear the bombs coming down on Hornet next door, which I suppose is what they were after, and you can hear these sticks, each one getting nearer and nearer.
And
I can remember that the dryers, Desmond, who was my uncle's officer, realized that I was a Canadian alone, and so forth. So he used to come over, his wife came over, and eventually it took me away from my convalescence, like to Shedfield, the little house there, and I became one of the family, and we became very close friends ever afterwards. And my parents shipped over parcel after parcel of goodies.
Yeah.
This was their time when rationing was severe and so forth. They really were the hand of friendship that was extended with something that I forgot.
What was this next door? What was Hornet?
The MTB base and Dolphin, the submarine base.
So there was Hornet, the MTB base, and Dolphin, the submarine base, and that's what they were after.
Legitimate targets,
yes.
Hathor Hospital in Norton, it's a 2,000-bed hospital. It's a huge place. But they were awfully good. Queen's and Alexander Royal Nursing Service with their big capes and colors, and the doctors were all pretty good. But the epistaxis, it's called, it just started and it wouldn't stop.
You'll have to spell that for me, or I can put down nosebleed.
Epistaxis or something.
Epistaxis, yeah.
So, and that meant that I was fell astern in my course.
Yeah.
And when they all finished and went off, I had to stay on and rewrite, do exams. But I finished all right. They were qualified, and promptly was not employed at Montgomery job. At all, except for schools later on.
Where did you go then?
I went back to Canada and then was sent overseas again to London to commission HMCS Niobe at Greenock, the Smithson Institute, Poorhouse and Asylum, for Cuthbert, whom I was terrified.
Mm-hmm.
He was a terribly difficult man to serve.
Yeah, I know a bit about him. He was a terrifying man, yeah.
I think he was shy, in part.
Oh, I think a lot of... I've always thought Rollo Bingy was shy. He wasn't as effusive as most RN admirals I knew. He just couldn't carry on small talk.
Well, that's true. I think that's true. Yeah, small talk was not his thing. Cuff Taylor... he looked so fierce. Just looking at him, he looked on a filthy temper, and he was really quite nice. And I think he was a lonely man over there. But he couldn't stand me. I was still junior. You know, here I was trying to... I was responsible for opening up this bloody great place while he sat in line.
Yeah.
And they appointed me in command.
And
he protested to all and said, I should cancel it. I was far too inexperienced and able to be a man. He's quite right. Then he'd come up to London to visit to this bloody awful place. And he'd do rounds. And we'd have this traditional naval expedition of Masters of Arms, a group of about 20 people careering down corridors, and I'd say to the little cop, there's no point in going down here, there's no escape at the other end, and nobody would pay any attention, and they'd come up all standing like a spring being compressed against the locked door, and all the doors in the place, the knobs turned, but nothing happened.
No knobs,
it was a lunatic sound.
No knobs on the inside.
Oh, and so I
bitched and grumbled as much as I could and asked and requested to go to sea. I felt that the proper place for a young officer was at sea. And fortunately, at that time, Ottawa was in Londonderry, the destroyer. And Frank Caldwell was the XO, who did not get on with Bill Donable, the captain.
Oh.
And so it was an exchange appointment. I think the background was, but I think that's a reasonable explanation.
So you went there as number one?
Yeah. Delighted.
Tell us about Ottawa, then.
Well,
Let's just take a moment's break.
Yes, I got the impression that Ottawa was not a particularly happy ship. I had never met Commander Doe Donald before. I was in for something of a surprise, I must say. Our first undertaking was to return to Canada, and we had on board for passage Cuss Taylor, of all people, which struck me as faintly odd. But I found that under these changed circumstances, he was much more convivial and pleasant than he had thought I was working for him. At least I have to thank him, in part, for getting springing me loose from HMCS Niobe and getting me back to see where I belonged. I found during my time in the Ottawa that I had some difficulty with my captain, Doe Donald. He was a much older man. Indeed, he'd been involved in the fishery reserve.
Yeah.
He had never really had much destroyer experience. And I certainly had, I felt at that time, quite a lot.
Yeah.
He tended to drink rather much. At times when he would have been better advised not to have. And I can remember on one occasion in St. John's Harbor, we were about to sail on a transatlantic convoy and end up in Londonderry. We had to recover a seaboat, a whaler, and I'm not quite sure why, but the problem of hoisting this boat with the ship moving through the harbor, and I was trying to get the captain to slow down, otherwise we would have a disaster. And he wouldn't do it. We managed to get the boat up out of the water before there was a sad incident. I found that the yeoman, in fact, on many occasions, was acting almost as captain on the bridge because those mental processes were not capable of coping with what was required. This was quite a worry to me because my job was not to be on the bridge but to be running the rest of the ship for the captain, and I did my best. I feel he was really out of his depth and uncertain as to what was required of him. This was not a very happy situation, really. But I got on well with him. I can remember on one occasion when his temper manifested itself, and with a justification, when we were in harbor, and he was in his after cabin. In fact, he was having a bath when, during the process of refueling, the after tanks flooded, and he was sitting in Imperial State in his freshwater bath surrounded by a sea of oil. What a terrible sight that was. But it wasn't my fault, fortunately. He was relieved later on in the summer of 1942 by Larry Rutherford, who was a very able officer, young and capable, efficient, everything that the destroyer captain should be, and it was a breath of fresh air as far as I was concerned. And his theory was to work hard, play hard, of course, seems to be the standard naval procedure. But we got on well together, but I realized that I was going to have to work hard to produce the sort of efficiency that he considered would meet his standard. We crossed the Atlantic with a convoy. I don't know how many convoys we did, but the time was getting close to September. The ship was anchored at Mobile. We painted her. She looked absolutely lovely. The last coat of paint ever put on her. I think I took the last photograph of her, actually, at that time. It must have been a borrowed camera, because otherwise the film would have been lost. And we sailed from Mobile with convoy ON-127. And up until that time, I had bemoaned the fact that we never seemed to have any excitement in all my transatlantic voyages with convoys, and that I was going to live to regret that statement. The convoy ON-127 was attacked by 13 U-boats in the middle of September. The action went on for 2 or 3 days, and eventually we were torpedoed on the night of September the 13th at 11:20.
1942.
And the... I don't know how much you want me to go into.
All this. Pretty, yeah, no, all that you want. I mean...
I should say that leading up to this, after we'd sailed from Londonderry, Able Seaman Bucheski came down with appendicitis. And we were too far out, and the escort was too small, I suppose. And the realities of the war did not make it possible for us to return so he could be put ashore. And the doctor, George Hendry from Toronto, decided that an operation had to be done. And he asked me if I would assist, and I said I would. And so we went through the business of lashing the patient to the table in the captain's cabin and getting on with it.
Was there much of a sea running?
And there was a fair sea running, a swell, and the ship was moving about.
Who applied the anesthetic?
The doctor.
Mm-hmm.
But I handed the bits and pieces to him and took them from him and watched this business performed. It didn't particularly disturb me. And the operation was considered to be a success. And Able Seaman Bucheski, who I'll remember at my dying day but my left front tooth was thumped by him with a hockey stick during a game and is dead, but still in my mouth as a reminder of Pooch Bucheski, popular member of the ship's company at the time. But anyway, he was put away in his bunk. And then the attack on the convoy started, and various ships were torpedoed, and we picked up the survivors from one, and included amongst the lot was a severely injured man with a rivet blown through his gut. And
a rivet?
From the explosion.
Yeah.
Yes. And the doctor said that we've no choice but to operate, and would I help with others. The others, during the operation, fled because they couldn't stand the sight of the blood and so forth. But to me, it was an education to see a man's gut, 28 feet of it, to being taken out like a boat's falls and stitched up and put back in again. It was an operation that went on, I think, for 4 hours or so. It was a tremendous strain on the doctor, of course. And the man, the operation was eventually finished. But the man subsequently died. And on the morning of September the 13th, we rallied around on the quarterdeck with a firing party and a little burial ceremony, which I conducted, and we committed the man to the deep, not knowing that within almost 12 hours that many others would lose their lives. It was at 11:20 that night when I was in my turned in, and I heard the propellers increase speed markedly, which on a convoy is a signal that something is happening. I got up and went up onto the upper deck. It was calm, dark night, no moon, no wind. And I heard over the sound power telephone a voice on the bridge say, port 15. And then I guess a few seconds afterwards, there was the most shattering explosion. The sky momentarily lit up. You know. And then absolute silence, and then a rain of bits and pieces coming out of the sky and falling into the sea all around us, and I thought, good God, we've been hit. And I was all alone on the quarterdeck. The lifeboat boy sentry had disappeared, so I believe, somewhere. And I just stood there in a state of shock, rushed down to my cabin, picked up my life belt, morphine syrettes, my Luger, and the three things in the flashlight. And back up on deck, went forward and up onto the bridge to report to the captain and told him that I would go down and inspect the damage. Looking over the front of the bridge, there was nothing left. The bow had gone right back to the V-gun so I went down below. There's a shambles in the passageways where you notice boards falling down, broken glass, darkness, confusion. This was, as I say, nearly midnight. But anyway, I'm not quite sure who I was with, but we went down to what was left of the Stoker's Nest Deck, which was abaft the floor lower, on that lower level, where the Aztec is. And it was a scene of carnage and chaos. The force of the explosion had driven men in their hammocks up under the deckhead. It wasn't a pretty sight. The wreckage in the what was left of the Nest Deck was halfway up the door of the Aztec Cabin. Of course, it's a door that opens outward, but occupants.